I next met with Dr. Suresh Ramalingam from Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
So this is a patient I continue to see. I just saw her 2 weeks ago in my clinic. She's 83 years old, and about 4 years ago, she was diagnosed with advanced stage non-small cell lung cancer. It was an adenocarcinoma. She had presented with an upper lobe mass in the right lung with multiple bilateral pulmonary nodules. And when we conducted molecular testing, she had an exon 19 EGFR mutation. So we treated her with erlotinib, 150 milligrams per day, which she tolerated well and achieved a partial response and did really well. And we saw her every 3 months. And for the first year and a half, everything was fine. And then towards the second half of year two, we started seeing some of the pulmonary nodules start increasing in size. Initially, they were minor increases, and therefore we decided to keep her on erlotinib. But a few months later, there was full-blown progression. These nodules were doubling and tripling in size, and there were new nodules, and she was beginning to experience cough and some dyspnea. So at this point, we tested her plasma as the first step in our algorithm for T790 mutation. And she indeed harbored the T790 mutation. So we started her on osimertinib, 80 milligrams per day, about 8 months ago. And within the first few weeks, she started noticing improvement in her cough. She was feeling better overall. And the scan showed a significant reduction in the size of her nodules. Some of them were gone. And she has maintained her PR. She's fully active, fully functional in her full-time work, which she does. She's an artist and she paints and goes to shows and exhibits her paintings. And she's able to do all of those things quite well. And she was seen with a scan 2 weeks ago and is looking good.
So just to go back through a few points in her case, beginning with her first diagnosis when she was put on erlotinib, she was 83 years old. I guess it sounds like she was in very good condition.
She had a good performance status to start with, and she had minimal comorbidities. She was a never smoker, and she wasn't somebody who's been in a hospital in a long time until she presented with the lung cancer.
Where do you stand today in terms of selection of a first-line TKI? We have three available, and does it matter what type of EGFR mutation it is in making that determination?
So, you know, the two common hotspots, EGFR exon 19 and 21, these are the patients where EGFR TKIs work really well. Erlotinib and gefitinib are the first-generation agents, and afatinib is the second-generation agent. And these are all approved based on phase 3 trials that showed that they were better than chemo. But what's exciting now is we've started seeing results of trials that compared one agent to the other. And there are two trials we have data from. One compared afatinib to gefitinib, and in that trial, there was a modest PFS benefit. But afatinib also had more adverse events. There was also a study that showed perhaps if you had exon 19 mutation, afatinib may be a better drug for you than if you had an exon 21 mutation. There was a trial reported that compared another second-generation EGFR drug called decomitinib, and that was compared to gefitinib, and that trial showed a significant improvement in PFS, 14 and a half months versus 10 months, favoring use of second-generation drug over first-generation. So at least based on one phase 2b and one phase 3 trials, I think it's fair to say that the second generation drugs seem to have a higher efficacy compared to first generation drug like erlotinib or gefitinib, but they also come with higher toxicity. So if you have an older patient, such as my 83-year-old lady, I perhaps would still stick with the first generation drug like erlotinib or gefitinib, but if I had a younger patient, I might be more inclined to put them on afatinib and decomitinib, if and when it becomes available.
Do you see that same tolerability issue, particularly in terms of diarrhea with dacomitinib that you see with afatinib?
They seem to be very similar in terms of adverse event profile.
What's your clinical experience with afatinib? Do you use preemptive antidiarrheals, for example?
At the approved dose of 40 milligrams a day, I do see more diarrhea and skin toxicity. Teaching the patients about how to manage this proactive antidiarrheals, proactive skin prophylaxis are important. Very often, I end up reducing the dose to 30 milligrams per day, which seems to be a much better tolerated dose.
So I'm curious with your 83-year-old lady, how did she tolerate the erlotinib compared to the osimertinib?
Most of the patients that I have treated with osimertinib in the second line after they have received erlotinib in the first line tell me that this is a lot easier compared to what they went through first-line therapy. Now, that could be a result of two factors. One could be, and one is possibly attributed to the fact that osimertinib is more selective to the mutant receptor and has less of an effect on wild-type receptor, so the toxicity profile is better. The second is perhaps the skin has already been treated with an EGFR TKI and it's been primed and perhaps less sensitive when you expose a second agent.
How about with this lady?
This lady actually did much better. With the first course of erlotinib that she received, skin was the main issue. She had some grade 1, grade 2 skin effects initially, which were much better as the treatment went on. But with osimertinib, she had practically no skin toxicity or GI.
So, of course, osimertinib came into practice in patients with T790 mutant disease. What do we know about it, though, in the patient who presents up front, generally without T790 mutation? And where are things now with the so-called FLORA trial that's comparing osimertinib to erlotinib up front?
Sure, I can go over that, Neil. We presented data looking at 60 patients with non-small cell lung cancer with EGFR mutation that received osimertinib as frontline therapy. And we reported that in those patients, the response rates were about 77%, and the median PFS was approximately 19 and a half months. But those exciting results led to the first-line trial FLORA, which compares osimertinib 80 milligrams per day to either gefitinib or erlotinib. This is a phase 3 trial. It accrued more than 500 patients. And we saw from a press release that it met its primary endpoint. We'll have far more information on the response rate, PFS, in this phase 3 trial.
So from what you've seen so far, it kind of reminds me a little bit about the questions that came up about alectinib versus crizotinib with ALK, which is why is it better? Is it just a better, targeted therapy, or is it something to do with better effect in the brain? What do we know about that in terms of EGFR and osimertinib versus, say, erlotinib?
Sure. So when you treat patients with erlotinib, gefitinib, or afatinib, nearly half of them will develop resistance mediated by T790. Now, what we can say is when you treat them frontline with osimertinib, in the phase 1 experience that we are publishing in JCO, not a single patient developed T790 as the resistant mechanism. So you're shutting down exactly entirely that pathway as a potential mechanism of resistance. And as a result of that, you see a median PFS that was reported in that trial of approximately 20 months. So when you have a patient with EGFR, now the current approach is you give them erlotinib or gefitinib or afatinib, you have a median PFS of about 10 to 11 months, and half of them will develop T790, and you give them osimertinib, and you get another median PFS of about 10 months to 11 months. So the case has been put forward, by giving both of these in a sequential approach, you might get to 20, 22 months. But the fact that is not accounted for is what happens to the other 50% that does not develop T790, and they don't get a chance to have a better outcome. So this is shifting the biology of disease away from T790 and having a strategy that delays and avoids resistance. And this is what all of our strategies with targeted therapies are. How can we delay resistance? How can we avoid resistance? We also know that osimertinib has activity in the brain. But in my view, a lot of the effect may be from shutting down T790 and perhaps some to the brain effects of it.
Globally, are brain mets more of a problem in terms of resistance, particularly in the first-line setting with ALK as opposed to EGFR?
Yes, the ALK-positive patients tend to have brain mets far more commonly than we see with EGFR mutation.
So is it your take, because this issue came up again with ALK and alectinib, that indirectly, is it going to turn out that by giving osimertinib up front, I guess people talk about the time to progression compared to going with, say, erlotinib, and then in, as you say, the patients with T790, osimertinib. Globally, do you think there'll be a greater global benefit to patients by starting with osimertinib?
I think if the phase 3 trial results show that the type of results we saw in the phase 1 experience are held up, when you have a median PFS of approximately 19, 20 months, it would be hard not to use that in the first-line therapy. Another factor is tolerability. We know that osimertinib is easier for patients to tolerate compared to either erlotinib, gefitinib, or afatinib. So I do feel that there will be a shift in paradigm if these numbers hold up.
I wanted to ask you also, this lady was diagnosed with T790 disease based on a plasma assay, as a lot of people are nowadays. And I'm kind of curious what you would have done or how you would have thought it through if she had been T790 negative. And particularly I'm interested, and I don't know if this applies to her, in the situation where it's still going to be difficult to get tissue. Is there a way to make this determination without, you know, say somebody has some bone mets or something, patient's older, et cetera? Is there a way to just rule out T790 purely using plasma?
The plasma is a good initial step that we use in our algorithm. The current assays are quite sensitive for T790, and the sensitivity of these assays range anywhere from 50 to 85% across studies. So if you did a plasma test and you detected it, that's enough evidence to proceed with therapy with osimertinib. But if the plasma test was negative, I would still have tried to get a biopsy of one of the pulmonary nodules for this patient, because there is a 15 to 30% chance you missed that T790 on the plasma. Now, if you had no disease to biopsy and the patient only had bone-only disease, that is a bit of a problem, because if the plasma is negative in those patients, you are left with a bone biopsy, which does not provide you with material that's conducive for genetic testing. I would still try to test it. I wouldn't completely shy away from testing it before I make my treatment decision.
So, I mean, I guess I don't know if you could actually access it, but theoretically you could do sort of empiric osimertinib. But the other thing I've heard about, I think it was Heather Wakely, actually in an interview for this series, is in the T790 patients to see in the plasma if the mutation is detected. And that if it's not there, you know, the basic EGFR mutation, then you're less confident. If you see it there, more confident. I hadn't heard that before. Have you heard that?
Yeah, I have heard that theory. In other words, if your EGFR mutation is present, then you are detecting something coming out of the tumor. And when you don't see T790, it's more likely to be a true negative as opposed to a plasma test that does not detect any mutation at all. And again, I think that's perhaps one possible way to get to the answer. But these mutations are present in much smaller frequency of tumor cells, and therefore, it's not a foolproof way to say whether you have a right negative or a false negative.
So this also brings up the issue of the potential use of TKIs with people with targeted therapy in the adjuvant setting. I thought maybe you could comment a little bit on the Alchemist study that you're so involved with. It kind of seems like osimertinib, not only is it seems like it's going to be more effective to start with, but also to take TKI for a year or two might be a lot easier if it's osimertinib. But where are we right now in terms of trials looking at this question? And are we looking at osimertinib in the adjuvant setting?
Yes, the Alchemist study is for patients with early stage non-small cell lung cancer, stage 1B to 3A. These patients all undergo surgery. And if they are candidates for adjuvant chemo, they get 3 to 4 cycles of platinum-based chemotherapy. And while they are getting chemo, they are screened for EGFR and ALK. If they are EGFR positive for mutation, then after they complete chemo, they're randomized to erlotinib or observation, and they get it for 2 years. And if they are ALK positive, they get crizotinib or observation. And if they are negative for both EGFR and ALK, we now have a third arm, which is NEVO versus observation, and the NEVO is given for 1 year. So that's the framework of Alchemist. The goal is to screen about 8,000 patients. So we have about 350 EGFR, about 350 ALK-positive patients, and about 700 patients on the immunotherapy arm.
So the targeted therapy and the checkpoint inhibitor are after adjuvant chemo?
That is correct. So the standard approach is you give adjuvant chemo and then you randomize them to one of the targeted immunotherapy approaches. But if a patient, say, is declining adjuvant chemotherapy or the patient is not a candidate, you can then directly go to the next step of the trial, which is the randomization.
Any comment about the trial presented at ASCO looking at adjuvant gefitinib versus chemotherapy? I thought that was really an interesting study.
Yes, that study from the Chinese cooperative group by Dr. Wu showed that gefitinib had a much better disease-free survival compared to chemotherapy. Now, it's a relatively small study, and one of the main caveats is for patients randomized to the chemotherapy group, nearly 25% of them did not get any chemo at all. So that basically dilutes the results that you see, because it was not a comparison of chemo versus gefitinib for all patients. It's chemo versus gefitinib for 3/4 of the patients and gefitinib versus nothing for the remainder of the patients. So our approach is chemo is proven in this setting. At this point, those data from the Chinese cooperative group, while interesting, are not sufficient to displace chemo out of the treatment algorithm for patients with EGFR mutation.
Although, I mean, it is kind of strange to think about the idea of receiving chemo knowing that you can take an oral therapy that's going to give you a higher PFS. I guess you have to believe in the survival data.
So the study was relatively early in its readout. The median follow-ups are relatively slow. We don't have any information on overall survival. And this was a very early look at the top-line results. We anticipate getting more data. I agree with you. If we see good results with gefitinib alone, which is an oral agent that patients can take at home, and if it results in a dent in the overall survival, even better than chemotherapy, then we would absolutely adopt that.
So again, getting back to your 83-year-old lady, if she were clearly T790 negative, now she sounds like she's starting to get symptoms from the disease. How would you have treated her? Would it have changed based on what her PD-L1 level or TPS numbers were?
Sure. So our approach for T790 negative patients has been to go to a platinum doublet combination. In this case, a carboplatin pemetrexed regimen would be the one that I would have used. Now, if her PD-L1 expression was really high, whether an immune checkpoint inhibitor would be effective in this space is a question for which we don't have a clear answer. So my approach would be I would still use the platinum doublet and then go to checkpoint as the next line of therapy for her in that situation.
Why don't we move on and hear about your 63-year-old lady?
Sure. So this is another 63-year-old patient. She was diagnosed with stage 4 adenocarcinoma based on presentation with pleural effusion, which resulted in shortness of breath, and subsequently the fluid was tapped, and she was found to have a malignant effusion. She also had bilateral nodules, and testing revealed ALK positivity. So she was seen in clinic, and we were going to start her on a first-line crizotinib. We also had a clinical trial with crizotinib and an immune checkpoint inhibitor, and she opted to enroll in the clinical trial. And she started the treatment, but within a few weeks, she developed elevation of liver enzymes. And that resulted in treatment interruption, and we had to treat her with steroids and discontinue the checkpoint inhibitor as required by the protocol. And then we reintroduced the crizotinib after a few days. And sure enough, her liver enzymes started going up again with crizotinib exposure. So at that point, we decided that continuing on with crizotinib is no longer likely to be safe. So we stopped it and we switched her to alectinib. But before we did that, we got a scan which was to serve as the baseline for alectinib. And interestingly, that showed a good response to treatment. And now she's been on alectinib, which she tolerated really well. Her liver has not been affected by this therapy. She has a partial response that's been maintained. She's now, I would say, about 8 months into treatment and is doing really well.
Can you talk about where we are in terms of choosing agents for ALK disease? We saw some first-line data at ASCO looking at alectinib. We'd seen some the year before. And we have a new drug approved, brigatinib. Can you talk about kind of where these data and this new agent fits in?
Sure. So our treatment paradigm until recently was crizotinib as the first-line treatment. And then when patients develop resistance, we had two options. We could go to seritinib or alectinib, which are both potent ALK inhibitors, second-generation ALK inhibitors. Seritinib actually is now approved in the first-line setting as well, and that was based on a phase 3 trial that compared it to chemo, and the median PFS with seritinib was over 16 months. And with crizotinib, we would expect a median PFS of about 10 months. So seritinib is an approved option. And then alectinib, which is also an effective agent, was compared to crizotinib in a phase 3 trial. Now, there are two phase 3 trials, one done in Japan, one done rest of the world, that compared alectinib with crizotinib. And both these trials resulted in very impressive hazard ratios for progression-free survival. In the Japanese trial, the hazard ratio was 0.34, favoring alectinib, and the median PFS there was over 2 years. And in the ALEX trial, which is in the Western population, the hazard ratio for PFS was 0.46. So based on these results and the good tolerability of alectinib, I think that alectinib is going to move to the first-line setting. It is not FDA approved for the first-line indication, but I think based on these compelling data that we've seen from two trials, it's going to be there in the first-line space. Brigatinib is another interesting agent, And it's approved in the second-line space after patients develop resistance to crizotinib. And what stood out to me about brigatinib is the median PFS in the second-line space with brigatinib in these phase 2 studies was approximately 15 months, which is way higher than what we've seen with all the other agents in the second-line space. And brigatinib also has activity in the brain, which alectinib and seretinib do as well. But when you look at the median PFS results, it really stands out. Now, we're not allowed to compare across clinical trials, but we do have to make decisions based on data that we have in front of us. And I feel that brigatinib is a good agent in the second-line space. So it's given at a dose of 90 milligrams, you give it for 1 week. The main adverse event is this pulmonary toxicity that can happen in about 5% of the patients that declares within the first week. And if you don't see any toxicity, week two, you go up to 180 milligrams of that drug. So that's the approved regimen with brigatinib.
So I'm curious what your second-line therapy is for a patient whose first-line therapy is crizotinib and alectinib and even seretinib. What would be your second-line therapy for all those patients?
So if a patient got first-line treatment with crizotinib, until now we've been using alectinib or seretinib, but since the approval of brigatinib, I've started using that agent as well. Now, as the landscape shifts when patients get first-line alectinib therapy, the question is, what's the appropriate second-line agent? We have some anecdotal reports of one drug, such as seretinib or brigatinib. We don't know a whole lot, but what is promising in this space is a drug called lorlatinib, which in a phase 2 study has shown activity in patients who develop resistance to one or two prior lines of ALK inhibitors. So I anticipate lorlatinib could be another agent. For now, for lack of anything better, I would try brigatinib in these patients because brigatinib does have better activity against some of the resistance mutations that you see in ALK-positive patients that develop acquired resistance.
What do you see in terms of tolerability, particularly with seretinib? I know there were concerns about GI toxicity, about the dose. How did that sort of play out?
So seretinib is approved at the dose of 750 milligrams once a day. And at that dose, we do see more GI toxicity. So I often, when I start seretinib, start at a dose of 600 milligrams per day and do appropriate GI prophylaxis. And by giving it with food, you actually improve bioavailability and also reduce toxicity. So there's some data that when you give seretinib at 450 milligrams and have the patient take it with food, it's much better tolerated. So 600 as a starting dose, if needed, dose reduction to 450 is the approach we use in our clinic.
So I'm curious, you know, you gave an explanation in terms of osimertinib up front in terms of the T790. What about, for example, alectinib versus crizotinib? I've heard the term alectinib is a better ALK inhibitor. I'm not sure exactly where that comes from or how it plays out clinically. Again, there's the issue of brain mets. Why is it that it seems to be better in the first line?
The explanation goes back to crizotinib was originally being developed as a MET inhibitor, and it also has ALK activity. So it's not a selective ALK inhibitor. Now, once crizotinib was approved, the development of the drugs that are very specific and potent against ALK were developed, and that's where seretinib and alectinib come in. So they do have a more potent inhibition. If you look at preclinical models, just as the IC50, which is the amount of drug that's needed to kill 50% of the tumor cells, alectinib and seretinib and brigatinib do much better than crizotinib. So that sort of a potent ALK inhibitory effect could explain why they do better. And also the fact that these agents have much better brain activity compared to crizotinib could account for the fact that you're suppressing development of brain metastases for a longer period with these agents.
So I really want to hear about this 64-year-old lady. What an incredible case.
Yes, I mean, she's a remarkable lady who comes 5 hours from Atlanta to me. And when she presented, she actually had developed respiratory difficulty, significant dyspnea, worsening cough, and found out to have significant involvement with her right lung and bilateral diffuse pulmonary infiltrates. And a workup resulted in the diagnosis of lung adenocarcinoma. But unfortunately for her, at the same time, workup also showed a nodule in her right breast. And that was biopsied, and that was breast cancer. So she had two cancers. The good news was she had good functional status. She didn't have any other comorbid medical conditions. So she was seeing me and one of my breast cancer colleagues and the breast cancer surgeon, and the team decided to give her 4 cycles of treatment with carboplatin and paclitaxel because she was clinically sick. We didn't want to wait for any molecular testing to come back. We thought carboplatin paclitaxel would affect both breast cancer and lung cancer, get her lung cancer under a little bit control, and then do the surgery for breast cancer.
What was the ER and HER2 status on the breast cancer?
She was ER PR negative for breast cancer.
And how about HER2?
Her HER2 was positive.
Wow, interesting. So you gave her chemo.
We gave her 4 cycles of chemo for lung cancer, and she showed stabilization and some improvement in her symptoms, but radiographically, there was not much of an improvement. So stable disease would be the best at that point. And she did go on to have surgery. So we had to interrupt treatment while she had the surgery and came out of surgery. Fortunately for her, the breast cancer was stage 1. There was no nodal metastases, which we knew ahead of time that she did not have extensive breast disease and it was a small lesion. So the good news was the breast cancer was out, but the bad news was it had been 3-4 months since her last chemo, and she started getting worse, and she had developed a pleural effusion. She had lymphangitic carcinomatosis involving the lungs. She required a lot of oxygen. And by then, we had the results of her lung cancer molecular testing available, and we knew she had a BRAF V600D mutation. This was almost 14 months ago, and at that time, there was no approved therapy for BRAF mutation. So we had to get the combination of dabrafenib and trametinib through the company as part of their patient support program. And the dramatic part is within a few weeks of starting the treatment, she came off oxygen, her breathing status improved considerably. She was able to ambulate, go out of her house. And when we saw the scans 2 months later, we were truly amazed at the extent of response. She tolerated the treatment well, and now she is continuing to lead a normal life and continues to be on therapy, doing extremely well.
So first of all, I'm sure she's really glad she's making that 5-hour trip. Sounds like it really made a difference. I'm not sure how many people in this country would be getting a BRAF mutation, although it certainly seems like it ought to be done based on not just this, but many other cases. I'm curious, you know, of course, this combination was used in a melanoma for a while. We've heard about those toxicities for a while. What did you see in her, and what have you seen in general with this combination in lung cancer?
So the phase 2 study that looked at this combination has recently been published. It showed that the response rate was quite impressive, close to 65%, and the median PFS was approximately 10 months. Suggesting it's in the same ballpark as what you would get with an EGFR mutated patient with erlotinib or one of the TKIs. The tolerability for this combination is not a walk in the park, as one of the PIs told me from the study. Fortunately for my patient, we did not encounter any toxicities, but GI toxicities, fatigue, some rare instances of ocular toxicity are all seen with the combination approach. So if a patient who's on this combination develops eye symptoms, it's important to get them to see an ophthalmologist right away.
What about fever?
Fever is also something that's been noted in a subset of patients. She did not experience any of those things. And I think given the extent of how bad her lung cancer was, it's possible that she doesn't even appreciate some of these symptoms. But fever is reported with the combination.
Really interesting story. I'm kind of curious, if she were to present to you today up front and you knew she had a BRAF mutation, of course, now you know she responds better, but just in general, how do you approach the symptomatic patient who has a BRAF mutation up front?
My approach would be to give them targeted therapy, the combination of dabrafenib and trametinib in the first line setting, and use chemo in the second line setting for those patients up front. So testing for BRAF is part of our panel now, and we test patients for EGFR, ALK, ROS1, and BRAF at a minimum in the front line.
And I'm sure that applies to patients with EGFR and ALK in terms of, again, the sick patient. But what do we know, though, about the time to response and the chance of early response, chemo versus targeted therapy?
In patients with these driver mutations, responses happen very early. In fact, when you go back and look at the early studies of erlotinib and gefitinib, when you look at patient-reported outcomes of how early they can feel symptomatic benefit, you see in 1 to 2 weeks, these patients start noticing improvement in their symptoms and overall sense of well-being. So I would say that these responses do occur quite early. In 2 to 3 weeks, we see a clinical improvement in patients with driver mutation who are given targeted therapies. So I wouldn't hold back on targeted therapies under the notion that chemo perhaps may work sooner.
So I want to finish out in terms of the cases with your 63-year-old man.
Yeah, so this is a patient who had comorbid conditions. He has type 2 diabetes. He had presented with shortness of breath and an episode of pneumonia. He was hospitalized. And during that time, they found that he had a lung mass. It was biopsied. He had stage 4 disease based on metastatic disease to liver and bones. His histology was squamous cell. And his performance status, I would say, after he had recovered from the pneumonia was 1. And therefore, he was a candidate for combination chemotherapy. But when we looked at what are the options for him, we decided to go with carboplatin and nab-paclitaxel for 2 reasons. One, of course, in squamous histology, this combination has resulted in a slightly higher response rate compared to carboplatin and paclitaxel. Number 2, with this type 2 diabetes, not exposing him to steroids would be a good thing because with nab-paclitaxel, we do not need steroid pre-medications. So that was the reason we decided to do it. He was also living not too far from our center, so he could come every week and get this treatment. So we started him on carboplatin and nab-paclitaxel. He did experience a reduction in size of the tumor. It did not meet the criteria for PR, but definitely felt that it helped him. His improvement in symptoms were seen after the first cycle of therapy. So we treated him for 4 cycles. And then once we reached the point of maximal response, we kept him on nab-paclitaxel maintenance for a few more months. And now the maintenance part is not something that's approved or proven, but we felt that given his underlying disease burden, giving this as a maintenance would be beneficial. And so that was the rationale for this regimen for him.
And what's his current situation?
He did well on maintenance for another 5 months, and then he progressed. And more recently, we've started him on a checkpoint inhibitor.
Which one and what's happened so far?
So he's been started on atezolizumab. He has received 2 cycles of therapy. His symptoms are stable. We went back and looked at his PD-L1 expression, and his expression was approximately 20%.
So any tolerability issues with atezolizumab?
No, he's actually tolerated it quite well, and he's coming up for a scan in the next few months for the next one.
Can you talk about how you generally approach second-line therapy of squamous in patients with low TPS scores and how you choose a checkpoint inhibitor and why you chose this atezo in this patient?
So in the second-line setting, if a patient has not received first-line checkpoint inhibition, you know, obviously if you had squamous patient with a greater than 50% expression, they would get a first-line pembrolizumab. But let's say this patient's PD-L1 status was not at that point, or they were treated with chemotherapy for whatever reason in the first-line setting. For those patients, we, as you know, have 3 approved options: pembro, nivolumab, and atezolizumab. Pembro is approved only if their PD-L1 expression is greater than 1% on label, and both nivo and atezo are approved regardless of the PD-L1 expression status. Now, the efficacy of all of these drugs in the second-line space seem very similar. If you look at hazard ratios from these phase 3 trials for survival, it's consistently around 0.72, 0.73. So we don't think their efficacy is much different. The main difference is boiled down to how often you give these drugs. Nivo is given every 2 weeks. Pembro and atezo are given every 3 weeks. So for that reason, from a patient convenience standpoint, atezo and pembrolizumab have become now more go-to drugs in the second-line space in our practice. And we chose atezo because at the time we started him on therapy, we did not have the PD-L1 expression status. We didn't want to wait for it. We said with atezo, we can just start him right away without having that information.
So another potential consideration in him up front with having squamous cell would be nesotumab. Is that something that you thought about? I mean, he's a younger patient, 63 years old. Is that something you thought about? Do you ever utilize it?
So nesotumab is an approved agent in combination with platinum doublet in squamous histology. The PFS and overall survival results were modestly improved. So it is a consideration in the setting. We did not choose it for this patient because of some of the comorbid conditions that he had, and we were worried about toxicity of putting a 3-drug combination, and therefore we gave him 2 drugs. But it's certainly an option that's FDA approved and is available for patients who have good performance status.
So I guess statistically, the most likely situation for him is going to be to have disease progression. Hopefully he will respond on the atezo, but more likely he won't. Assuming his performance status is still maintained, what do you think you're going to be thinking about next?
So in third line space, if the performance status is appropriate, then docetaxel with or without ramucirumab is the treatment option we go to outside of a clinical trial. If the patient's performance status is very good, I would give them the dozi-ramo combination. If they are not candidates for the combination, then I would just go with docetaxel monotherapy.
Any comments on ramucirumab in terms of tolerability issues? I've heard it, you know, kind of like Bev. Is that what you find?
Yeah, the profile appears to be similar. They have the class effect toxicities such as hypertension, proteinuria, but besides a small risk of bleeding, we also see some thrombotic phenomenon, arteriovenous thrombi, in some of these patients. So you just want to select patients based on comorbid conditions and risk for developing clots or bleeding. And then if they are appropriate, otherwise ramucirumab is well tolerated.
So I wanted to run through a few of the papers that you've been involved with and also some other papers I just kind of curious about. Beginning, you had a couple of papers I found interesting using metaphors to explain molecular testing to cancer patients. Can you talk about this work and what you saw there?
Sure. So as we talk about genome testing and results of genomic testing and what it means to patients, we did a study in our institution where it was very clear that it was not easy for patients to understand, and there is a subset of patients who have a hard time understanding what a mutation is, what a driver mutation is, and therefore we felt that it'll be helpful to develop some terminologies. And in this study, we had some investigators, we went to them and asked them, how do you explain molecular testing to your patients? And then we studied patients who were given those analogies and see which of those metaphors resonated more with them. And that's what this paper was. It's a small group of patients, but what we felt was when you use certain examples, for example, I often use the situation of a driver and a bus. If you're in a bus and the bus is going down fast, the best way to stop it is by, you know, the mutation is the driver in this case. The driver is responsible for the bus going fast, and the targeted therapies end up working at the level of the driver. So using those kind of examples, we felt resulted in a better understanding by the patients about what the whole genomic testing and treatment options based on that are about.
And from your own experience with your own patients, what do you find, you know, works best?
I use either the driver analogy, or I also use the switch on, switch off. I tell them, think about cancer cells as a room full of wires, and there is a switch to turn on and off. And the mutation in your case is the switch that's keeping the lights on. And by using a drug to switch off, you can actually turn the lights off, and therefore the cancer cell could die.
I wanted to also ask you about your work on mechanisms of resistance to EGFR TKIs with people with EGFR tumor mutations. And maybe you can talk a little bit about what you've seen in the laboratory. And also something actually really wasn't on my radar. I always think about EGFR T790. And recently I started to hear about MET alterations, even HER2 alterations that occur. Can you just sort of provide an overview of what we've learned about the biology of EGFR resistance?
Sure. So when we treat patients with erlotinib or gefitinib, you see a few escape pathways. T790 is by far the most common resistance mechanism. MET amplification or MET pathway activation is seen in about 5 to 10% of the patients. And then there are other rare escape pathways such as HER2 pathway, and you can even see an occasional BRAF mutation. So these are all signaling through various growth factor pathways. Now, what agent you give in the first line will dictate what potential mechanisms of resistance are going to develop. So in preclinical models, when we study EGFR mutated cells with a drug like osimertinib, what happens is these cells do not develop T790 because you're blocking that pathway. And when you look at what remains, the MET pathway becomes an even more important escape mechanism in these patients. It may be in the order of 20 to 30% where you see MET pathway activation. And that's where we're now developing combination approaches, combining a third generation EGFR inhibitor with, say, a MEK inhibitor. And in at least in the preclinical paper that we just published, there seems to be a significant tumor inhibition with that combination approach. So we're moving towards getting that to the clinic.
I want to ask you also about some of the work you've done in small cell cancer. And I was interested to see that you're actually looking at a PARP inhibitor actually PARPinder was obviously now approved in ovarian cancer. Really exciting data came out in breast cancer at ASCO. You've been involved with work with the drug veliparib, which is not approved, but combining it with chemo. What do we know about that in small cell?
Sure. So veliparib as a PARP inhibitor basically inhibits DNA repair. So when you give a platinum compound to a patient, you're trying to cause DNA damage, and that results in apoptosis and cell death, and that's how tumors respond to platinum. But the tumors have inbuilt repair mechanisms, so when you give a drug like veliparib, it blocks DNA repair and makes platinum work better. And that's the rationale behind these combination approaches. What you're referring to is a trial that we reported at ASCO from ECOG, which was a randomized phase 2 trial of platinum etoposide with veliparib versus platinum etoposide plus placebo as first-line therapy for patients with small cell lung cancer. This was a randomized phase 2 to look for a signal. And what we found was the PFS was improved in patients who got veliparib plus chemotherapy to a modest extent. Now, the hazard ratio is approximately 0.75. And the question is, can we identify biomarkers to select patients who benefit from this? Now, there have been some exciting advances in the preclinical understanding of PARP inhibition, and there are some putative biomarkers such as Schlafen-Levin that are being proposed as putative biomarkers for PARP inhibition. So we're now looking at these samples to see what their Schlafen-Levin expression is and see if this responds. The HRD score is the other score that has been linked with PARP inhibition, so we'll be looking at HRD score as a potential predictor as well and help finalize plans on further development of this strategy.
What else is going on with small cell? I know there's an antibody drug conjugate, Rova-T. It's hard to pronounce. What do we know about that therapy?
Rova-T is an antibody drug conjugate. The antibody itself targets a protein called delta-like ligand 3, which is seen in about 70% of small cells. And this drug conjugate has a toxin attached to an antibody. So essentially, you deliver the drug into the cancer cell by using this targeted approach. And the interesting part has been they've seen response rates of about 40% in patients with small cell lung cancer after they have received standard platinum doublets and even topotecan. This is in patients who are selected for the biomarker DLL3 expression. And this drug is given intravenously. They give every 6 weeks. You just give 2 doses of the drug and you see responses within the first several weeks. So this is an exciting development in the second-line small cell space. The drug is in advanced stage clinical trials. There are certain toxicities that we've seen with this drug, such as recurrent effusions, some skin toxicities that need to be managed proactively. But it is an interesting agent and hopefully will enter the treatment landscape for small cell lung cancer.
Have you used it yourself in a trial?
Yes, we have used Rova-T in clinical trials for a few patients in our trials.
Have you seen any patients with clinically meaningful responses?
We have seen at least one patient in our small cohort that has seen a good response to Rova-T. This is a patient with liver metastases and extensive chest disease who showed a good response to treatment and is now completed therapy and is on follow-up.
So when you think about the other antibody drug conjugates out there, T-DM1 in breast cancer, brentuximab vedotin in lymphomas, they seem generally well tolerated. I mean, there's a chemotherapy moiety in there, but you don't really see chemotherapy toxicity. Is that the case with this agent?
So the toxicity for these ADCs depend on where else your target protein is expressed. So if your protein is expressed in certain normal cells, then you're going to see toxicity related to that. So whether there is something to do with DLL3 in the serosal surfaces is not clear to me, but certainly we see ascites and pleural effusions in these patients.
In those few patients that you've treated, did any of them have significant clinical problems with effusions?
We have had at least one patient who ran into significant effusion problems and another patient who had some skin issues related to photosensitivity.
The other thing that seems to be out on the table with small cell is checkpoint inhibitors, but particularly I'm hearing a lot about combinations of, you know, anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1, Nivo, Ipi, for example. What about checkpoint inhibitors in small cell?
Still under investigation, but there are some studies that have read out. And what we've seen is PD-1 inhibition alone seems to have a response rate of about 10 to 11%. But when you combine CTLA-4 inhibition with the PD-1 inhibition, the response rates tend to be about 25%. So the combination approach is now being studied in randomized trials, but it's also already been put in the NCCN panel for salvage therapy of small cell lung cancer and can be used. And I take it that they decided to do that based on the fact that there isn't much to do for these patients at this time. So I think that the data with the combination of CTLA-4 and PD-1 are promising. I have one patient that I've treated who's been on this approach for almost 2 years with no evidence of disease. So I do think that this works in at least a subset of patients.
So a couple of final questions from some of the work you've done on checkpoint inhibitors. One, you had a poster looking at the toxicity profile of PD-1 versus PD-L1 agents. I've heard that debated ever since these things came into play. What did you all see? And in general, what has been seen initially? I was hearing things like maybe there's going to be less pulmonary toxicity with anti-PD-L1. What do we know about this?
So the initial premise was that PD-L1 inhibitors will have less autoimmune toxicities compared to PD-1 inhibitors. And that's what prompted our investigation. So we did an analysis of close to 6,000 patients that have been treated across PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors in lung cancer and looked at what were the adverse events of patients treated with PD-1, what were the adverse events of PD-L1, what were the efficacy results, are there any key differences of note? And this was presented in the World Conference on Lung Cancer by Dr. Pillai from our group. And she showed that there weren't many differences in toxicity between these two classes of drugs. They were very similar in terms of adverse events. And this paper should be coming out in Cancer Journal very soon. So this leads us to believe that these agents are very similar in terms of efficacy and toxicity as of now.
So I have to ask you about this case report you have of cardiac allograft rejection in a patient getting a PD-1 agent.
That was a very unfortunate situation where a patient who had received a heart transplant at Emory 20 years earlier and was doing very well, about a year and a half ago had developed a skin cancer, and he was treated at the West Coast, which is where he was living. And they had given him platinum doublet, which did not result in a significant response. And subsequently, they decided to give him a checkpoint inhibitor. And he got one dose of checkpoint inhibitor and within a few days developed significant heart failure. And he was brought to our ICU. And when we saw him on consultation, he was in full heart failure. And it was clear that that was prompted by the immune checkpoint inhibitor. So it is important that patients who have received organ transplants are not treated with checkpoint inhibition because you're going to start facilitating the rejection process. These have to be very carefully managed. And at least for the time being, until we know better, we should not be giving them checkpoint inhibition.
Did you say the patient had a skin cancer?
Yes, cutaneous squamous cell cancer.
Interesting. And what happened with the patient?
Well, we managed to improve the patient's heart failure, and he was able to be discharged home. But by the time we went home, he was on hospice, and he died a few weeks later.
From heart failure?
From heart failure and the consequences of his cancer as well. The heart failure improved, but his cancer was progressive.
Wow. Actually, when I saw that, I was struck because I had heard, you know, sort of anecdotally of patients with kidney transplants who got checkpoint inhibitors who, quote, did well. What do we know in general about people who've had organ transplants who get checkpoint inhibitors?
I think there's at least one study the Hopkins group is doing looking at transplant patients, and specifically in kidney setting, they have reported that it was safe to give them. My approach is in very highly controlled situations, it may be okay on a clinical trial to study how these patients do. But for our audience in the community who are taking care of these patients, it would be better not to treat these patients with checkpoint inhibition.
It's funny because somebody came up to me at ASCO and handed me an abstract and said, have you heard of daratumumab in lung cancer? We were about to do a myeloma session. I asked the myeloma people. They didn't know, but they were hypothesizing that it was based on the immune effects. And here I see that that's your study. Can you talk about what we know about daratumumab? I see you're looking at it with a checkpoint inhibitor.
Yes. So daratumumab is, as you know, approved for myeloma. It's a CD38 inhibitor. And there are preclinical rationale that suggests that when you combine CD38 inhibition with a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibition, there is considerable enhancement of anti-tumor immune response. So there is a randomized phase 2 study that's presently ongoing that combines atezolizumab with daratumumab. It's a small signal-finding phase 2 study, We had a lead-in cohort of patients where we just looked at the safety of the combination, and then we moved on to the randomized phase two part. So it's still early. The safety so far has been good, and we are anxiously awaiting the results of the trial.
I'm curious what you've been seeing with infusion reaction, because the myeloma people really have struggled with that.
That is correct. The infusion reactions with daratumumab require a prolonged infusion stay or prolonged stay in the infusion center. So those things are not much different when you use it in lung cancer patients, but they can be managed. It's usually in the first or the second time.
Have you thought about trying the sub-Q? That's out there now too.
At this point, we're still using the IV version. And when the signal in terms of PFS and efficacy results for the phase two are read out, we'll make a decision about whether that's a better approach to do.
Let's move on now and talk about the use of checkpoint inhibitors, specifically in first-line metastatic disease, where we've seen some new approvals and data sets, beginning with the use of pembrolizumab.
Pembrolizumab is approved for first-line therapy of non-small cell lung cancer, and this is in a biomarker-selected patients as monotherapy, a phase 3 trial that enrolled patients with advanced stage non-small cell lung cancer. And they selected patients whose PD-L1 expression in the tumor was greater than 50%. And this is an immunohistochemistry test that uses a specific antibody. And this level of positivity is seen in approximately 25 to 30% of patients with non-small cell lung cancer. And they randomized patients who were positive for PD-L1 at this 50% or greater threshold to get the standard platinum doublet chemotherapy or pembrolizumab as monotherapy. And the primary endpoint of this trial was to show an improvement in progression-free survival. And what you see is a significant improvement in progression-free survival from 6 months to 10.3 months, favoring the use of pembro as monotherapy, and a significant improvement in overall survival as well. The hazard ratio for PFS was approximately 0.5, and the hazard ratio for overall survival was approximately 0.6, resulting in the first positive trial in the frontline setting that showed improvement in survival with a novel agent over standard platinum doublet chemotherapy. So this is now an approved option in the frontline setting for patients with this high PD-L1 expression.
I'm kind of curious, when you start out first-line pembrolizumab in this identical situation, we see the response rate is about 45%. If the patient says to you, what's the chance that I'm still going to be without disease progression in a couple years? What would you say?
So that is the most intriguing part about immunotherapy, which is the patients who respond have a greater median duration of response. They sort of form the tail of the curve, as we like to call it, which is, can we increase the longevity of patient survival? And with immunotherapy, the best responders seem to hold on to their response a lot longer. So when you project some of the early studies that we have, the curves from those early studies, the 3-year survival rate with immune checkpoint inhibition appears to be in the order of 30 to 35%. So that's a much higher number than what we would expect to see with chemotherapy, even among some of the best responders.
So just a related question, which is, for how long do you continue treatment in a patient who's having a great response?
The standard protocol on the clinical trials has been to give it for a defined duration of either 2 years or 1 year for certain agents. So for pembro trials at our institution, they have required that the patients receive them for 2 years. So I think of this 2 year as sort of the de facto duration of therapy at this point. Clearly, this is an important question as to what is the optimal duration of therapy that's required. And there are studies that are being planned to address this. So for now, if a patient is tolerating it well and does not have any toxicities related to the autoimmune adverse events, then I continue it at least for a period of 2 years.
So, of course, the recent approval of the combination of pembrolizumab with carboplatin pemetrexed brought a very interesting dynamic into the situation. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the data there.
Absolutely. The approval, as you know, was based on a randomized phase 2 trial. This is an accelerated approval for pembro in combination with chemo for non-squamous patients in the frontline setting. This trial is now published. It enrolled about 120 patients. These were newly diagnosed patients with stage 4 non-squamous histology, and they were randomized to treatment with the doublet regimen, carboplatin and pemetrexed, or carboplatin pemetrexed with pembrolizumab. And for patients who get the three drugs, they were given the option of maintenance therapy with either PEM or PEM plus pembro or both. And majority of the patients, in fact, got both agents as maintenance therapy. The primary endpoint actually was response rate. There's a significant improvement in response rate for combining chemotherapy with pembrolizumab. And the median PFS was also improved. The median overall survival has not been reached for both groups. And the curves at this point don't look too different in terms of overall survival, but a clear separation for median progression-free survival. So this is the basis on which the drug was approved in combination with chemo. Keep in mind that they did not use PD-L1 expression as a selection criteria. So this trial included patients with all kinds of PD-L1 expression, starting from none to high expression. They also noted that the outcomes based on PD-L1 expression were not consistent across groups. For instance, when you look at the high expressors, greater than 50%, you see that the chemo plus pembro group did much better in terms of response rate compared to chemo alone. And for the overall group as well, we saw it was better. But when you look at the 1 to 49% expressors, the results were somewhat conflicting. The chemo plus pembro group didn't do quite as well, even as compared to chemo. But the problem is you're looking at a small trial and 60 patients in each arm. And when you break them down into smaller and smaller subgroups, what you're left with are statistically non-significant wide confidence intervals type of results. So at this point, this trial is a first step in my mind towards integrating chemo with pembrolizumab. There are phase 3 trials that have been either completed or are ongoing combining chemo with pembro, which will have much larger patient numbers and will hopefully help us determine which subset of patients should get, say, a checkpoint inhibitor alone, which group of patients should get chemo plus a checkpoint inhibitor, and whether there is a group where the combination doesn't work and we should just give chemo. So for my practice at this point, for the greater than 50% group, I'm still giving them pembro as monotherapy. For the less than 50% group, it's a conversation with the patient about chemo alone versus chemo plus pembro in the non-squamous histology.
So we've surveyed investigators about this issue, and it seems like in the greater than 50%, most but not all, the majority are doing what you do in terms of single agent pembrolizumab, although maybe 25-30% are using the combination. What about the patient who's sick and needs a response? They have a lot of tumor. The response rate seems higher. Would you be more likely to consider the combination in that situation?
Yes, absolutely. So there are some patients, as you said, where the clinical situation is such where you may just have one shot at giving them an effective therapy. If you don't turn them around, there may be no second-line therapy. So for those patients, clearly giving chemo plus pembro, which is associated with higher response rate, makes perfect sense. And these are symptomatic patients with large disease burden, rapidly declining performance status. Those are early indicators to me of where I would use the combination. Now, when I talk about declining performance status, we still want them to be at a point where they can receive these therapies, not somebody who's got a PS3 or 4. These trials were done in patients with a good performance status.
So, of course, when we talk about chemo plus a checkpoint inhibitor, we're talking about non-squamous. What do we know about chemo plus checkpoint inhibitor in squamous disease? Is there any reason to think it wouldn't kind of play out a similar way?
Not that we have. Let me take a step back. If you look at all the trials done with checkpoint inhibitors in lung cancer as monotherapy, the results in squamous and non-squamous have both been uniformly impressive. So I would not expect there to be a big difference between chemo plus checkpoint inhibition in squamous versus non-squamous. And those trials are underway or having been completed. So we should get those results in the very near future to see whether that combination can also be used in squamous subsets.
Can you talk about your overall algorithm for the management of patients with metastatic non-small cell?
When I have a non-squamous patient, molecular testing includes not just EGFR, ALK, and ROS1. I also test them for BRAF because there is an approved therapy. So for non-squamous patients, my initial testing panel includes at least those four genetic abnormalities for which there are FDA-approved treatment options.
Could I just throw in MET exon 14? Because we're seeing more investigators talk about using targeted therapy up front there. What about that?
That is another group where we have a promising ability to treat those patients with MET inhibitors. I didn't put that there because it's not an FDA-approved option at this point, but certainly in our institution, we do a wider panel that includes MET, HER2, and other additional abnormalities. But MET exon 14 is clearly a mutation which is seen in about 3 to 4% of the patients with lung cancer. It's higher in sarcomatoid histology if they have the mixed sarcomatoid tumors of the lung. And for those patients, giving a therapeutic trial of a MET inhibitor like crizotinib or cabozantinib, once they've gone through the platinum doublet, would be a reasonable approach.
So technically, the approval, I believe, of checkpoint inhibitors or pembrolizumab first line states specifically that it's ALK and EGFR negative.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious, though, about the issue of where checkpoint inhibitors fit in patients with driver mutations, particularly the common ones, EGFR, ALK, ROS1, and these others that you mentioned. Can you comment a little bit about the biology of this situation?
So what we've learned so far is that the higher the mutation burden in a tumor, the greater the likelihood of the immune system recognizing some of these mutated neoantigens. So mutation burden has been linked with sensitivity to immune checkpoint inhibition. Now, mutation burden tends to be higher in patients with a smoking history because of the repeated carcinogen exposures. And non-small cell lung cancer is among the tumors with the highest mutation burden. Now, when we look at EGFR and ALK tumors, we know that these tumors are seen more commonly in patients with minimal smoking history. And these patients, while they have a dominant driver mutation, their overall mutation burden seems to be much lesser compared to a smoking-related cancer patient's mutation burden. We've also seen some reports that the PD-L1 expression in these tumors are lower, and they may not have the right immune microenvironment to respond to immune checkpoint inhibition. So at this point, what we can say is for patients with an EGFR, ALK, or ROS1, or BRAF, targeted therapy seems to result in better outcomes compared to trying immune checkpoint inhibition, even though those sort of comparative trials have not been done at this point. What we know is from trials that compared chemo to checkpoint inhibition in the salvage therapy setting for non-small cell lung cancer, the patients with EGFR mutation actually fared better if they had received chemotherapy. And the hazard ratio across these trials was approximately 1.05 in favor of chemo, and this was based on a meta-analysis that was reported recently. So in my practice, I use the targeted therapies for patients with EGFR, ALK, and ROS first. And if they have the option of a second-line targeted therapy, I give them a second-line targeted therapy like osimertinib in EGFR patients or alectinib or brigatinib and seritinib in ALK patients. And then I go to a platinum doublet. Only then I would give them a checkpoint inhibitor outside of a clinical trial.
Could you just go back through this? Is there anything specifically, you talked about mutational load, anything else to maybe better explain the biology?
Katie Politi and Scott Gettinger from Yale, in an editorial they wrote in Clinical Cancer Research, talk about potential differences between an EGFR mutated untreated tumor versus a tumor that's been treated with an EGFR TKI. And even there, you start seeing changes in the tumor immune microenvironment as the tumor develops acquired resistance. And this can also be said for the ALK positive situation. So this tells us that there is a very dynamic process under play in patients whose tumors harbor these mutations. And it's not the same as what it was when you saw them before they got any treatment to the point where you see them after they have developed acquired resistance. And this has various implications on how antigens are presented, antigens are recognized, the immune microenvironment, including T regulatory cells. And therefore, there is a lot more left to be learned at this point. It's a bit too early in the game to see how best to combine immune checkpoint inhibition with targeted agents for patients with treatable driver mutations.
But at a more macro level, these biologic changes that are occurring as patients receive TKIs for targeted mutations, Does this make them more susceptible to immunotherapy?
One would make the case that as they go through acquired resistance and acquire more mutations, you might see a higher likelihood of response to immune checkpoint inhibition. But contrary to that, some of the studies that have been done so far have been quite slow to develop further because of some toxicity concerns that we've seen when you combine a TKI with a PD-1 or a PD-L1 antibody. So the initial experience has been somewhat mixed, and I would say as these trials proceed further, we'll see what's happening in the clinic to our patients. The meta-analysis was done to look at how the checkpoint inhibition strategy compared to chemotherapy alone based on whether a patient had EGFR mutation or wild-type EGFR. Now, we all know that there have been multiple randomized trials with Nivo, Pembro, and Atezo that compared these agents to docetaxel in the second-line setting. And these phase 3 trials all consistently showed that use of a checkpoint inhibition was associated with favorable survival compared to docetaxel alone. And this study basically pools all those data together to see how many EGFR mutated patients were included in these phase 3 trials and how did their outcomes compare to patients with EGFR wild-type tumors. Outcomes for patients with EGFR wild-type tumor consistently favor the use of a checkpoint inhibitor. And the cumulative hazard ratio is somewhere in the ballpark of 0.7. For EGFR mutated tumor patients enrolled in these trials, the composite hazard ratio was 1.05, suggesting that for these patients with EGFR mutation, chemotherapy did better than immune checkpoint inhibition. Now, we don't have information on ALK on these patients because those were a relatively small number of patients, but this goes on to say that it's not a given that if it works for everybody, it should work for EGFR mutated patients.
We should note that subsequent to recording these discussions, results from the phase 3 FLORA study were presented at the ESMO meeting, demonstrating that osimertinib significantly improved progression-free survival compared to standard of care EGFR TKIs for patients with EGFR mutated metastatic lung cancer. Results from the phase 3 PACIFIC study were also presented at the ESMO meeting and published in the New England Journal of Medicine, demonstrating that durvalumab significantly improved progression-free survival compared to placebo for patients with stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer after chemoradiation. In addition, alectinib was approved for first-line therapy in patients with ALK-rearranged metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Lung Cancer Update.